there has been aha moments. People think of respect as how just how you treat one another. But when you talk about it in terms of a manager, back to the what barriers can I remove, it's pointing out to leaders, whether they're a team leader or a supervisor, respect is also about giving people the tools they need to do their job, respecting and honoring that they have work to do and giving them enough time to do that.
Hey everyone, I'm Elizabeth Swan.
And I'm Tracy O'Rourke.
We're from GoalingSixSigma.com and you're listening to the Just In Time Cafe podcast, where we wrestle with tough questions, talk to thought leaders, discuss great books with great authors, and get insights from Lean Six Sigma practitioners.
And we let you in on helpful apps, bring you the news, and challenge the status quo so you can build your problem-solving muscles.
So Tracy, your favorite holiday is coming up.
I know, I'm so excited. And not just my favorite holiday, which is Halloween, but it's also my favorite time of year.
So do you have a costume already?
Well, of course, I have many costumes, probably 60. And so I don't know what I'm wearing on the day yet because I have so many choices. But my measure of success in October is how many days I get to wear a costume in October. And I'm hoping that at least 10 times or 10 days I get to dress up.
Excellent. I love that you have a goal.
You know, they always say, do more of what makes you happy. So I'm taking that by the horns. So, Elizabeth, what's on the menu today? Candy corn?
Yeah, candy corn and a few other tasty bits. This episode, we are dipping into our incredible experiences in Nagoya and Tokyo this year in my interview with Lori Fiorica and Hillary Hellman, two amazing leaders we met on Katie Anderson's Japan study trip. It's always fascinating to see the trip through someone else's eyes, and they were such good travel companions.
Yes, I agree. They were. We had a blast. We learned a lot, and we met some very interesting people.
Yeah. And then for our In the News segment, we can tell you about some upcoming conferences and one where you could run into us if you wanted to.
Or avoid us if you want
to. Or avoid us, since now you know we're there. For Q&A, we've got a listener's question about whether you can break the rules when using time-honored Lean Six Sigma tools. So stay tuned to find out how to stay out of improvement jail. And for the printed page, Tracy and I visit the wisdom of the accidental instructional designer. Part of our jobs in the continuous improvement world is to teach others, but there are some secrets and tips to doing that effectively. So stay tuned for some highlights from a plain-spoken and slightly sassy book about how to deliver content such that people can actually learn it. What kind of day is it, Tracy?
It's a sassy day at the cafe.
Yes, it is. Now share the candy corn.
Remember to stay tuned for this month's coupon code in order to get a discount on GoLeanSixSigma.com online training.
Well, let's get to the news.
Got some friends over at the Project Management Institute, don't we, Elizabeth?
Yes, we do. GoingSixSigma.com will be a sponsor at the 6th annual Instant Impact 2019 conference by PMI, which is the Project Management Institute, this year. So Instant Impact 2019 is PMI's 6th annual development event. It's happening Thursday, October 24th, 2019 at the Capital Event Center in Tumwater, Washington. Attendees can expand their knowledge, hone their management skills, learn from active practitioners, and gain insight about the tools and techniques and strategies that support personal and professional growth. The conference is going to feature some great speakers addressing topics focused on project and business management. If you're thinking about going, some good reasons to go are you could upscale your skills. You can network with other professionals. You can earn PDUs, that's professional development units, in all three areas of talent triangle. That's leadership, technical, and strategic business management. And you can educate others. The cost for registration is $280 for PMI chapter members and $315 for non-members. Make sure to register as soon as possible because the seats are almost all filled up.
Now, you may be wondering why we are attending a project management conference, but what we find is there's a lot of desire to learn the difference between a project management method and root cause analysis method. As a matter of fact, UC San Diego has created Greenbelt as an elective in their project management program. So hopefully that will help if you were wondering why we're talking about project management.
Yeah, there's some great alignment there.
We're also hoping to see you in Chicago next month at the AME conference in November from the 4th through the 7th. This is one of my favorite conferences. The keynote speakers last year blew me away, quite frankly. I was very inspired by them. Not only just the keynote speakers, but the attendees, the award winners. It's a great conference to go to if you are a zealot of continuous improvement. There's still time if you're interested, and we have a discount code if you'd like to attend that gives you 10% off. Use GOLEAN10. That's GOLEAN10. We'll be there with one of our favorite people, Angela Miller of UC San Diego. It's a wonderful event with 9 stellar keynote speakers this year, Richard Sheridan being one of them. He's the author of Joy Incorporated and Chief Joy Officer at Menlo Innovations. He'll be speaking along with a number of other luminaries. We also get to hang out with some of our coworkers located in Chicago. Kelvin, our Director of Client Experience, and Dane Dustimer is also located in Chicago. So I'm excited to see them because we're a virtual group. So we don't get to see each other that often. And we'll be all hobnobbing with some fantastic people at the conference. We are excited to meet up with a lot of our colleagues there, including Katie Anderson, who ran the Japan study trip, and Karen Martin, the award-winning author of many books.
I'm psyched for it, Tracy. It should be a great time.
Yes. You know, what I love about these conferences is you learn a lot and you have a lot of fun.
Definitely.
I'm Tracy O'Rourke, and you're listening to the Just in Time Cafe podcast.
Next up, it's Q&A.
So Elizabeth, I did get an opportunity to work with a jail on continuous improvement. And funny thing is, that is one place you do not want to increase flow of inmates. But the good thing about spending time in continuous improvement jail is that it's probably really efficient, right?
Right. Yeah, that's the upside. But this idea of doing things wrong stems from the listener's question, which is it okay to change and adapt these time-honored tools like 5S, 8 Waste, or PDCA, which is a great question. And the simple answer is yes, but there's a lot behind that. I remember reading Jeff Leiker, also a guest of this podcast, and Karen Ross's book, The Toyota Way to Service Excellence. Actually, both of them guests. Jeff Leiker wrote that Taiichi Ono and the originators of the Toyota production system, we know what eventually became lean manufacturing, they did not want it written down. They were against documentation because it was constantly evolving. They considered the whole method a living thing. And Jeff acknowledged that there had to be a compromise since it was so valuable for the rest of the world to know about it. And so he wanted to write about it. And of course, we're glad he did that, you know, but the idea is that things evolve and adapt. You know, PDCA evolved into PDSA. Some, like our good friend Karen Martin, prefer Plan, Do, Study Act instead of Plan, Do, Check Act because it reinforces that you're not just checking, you know, did someone comply? You know, you're spending time studying the outcome of a countermeasure. You know, did it really work? Should we tweak it? And some like Plan, Do, Check, Adjust, since do kind of sounds like act. So just to differentiate, you know, what are the adjustments you're going to make? And some prefer to make to PDCA because it breaks out all the activity in the plan step, which is, you know, define the problem, measure the problem, analyze the problem, and find the root cause before doing or improving and studying the results. So that's a lot of options, right, Tracy?
Yeah, there are a lot of options. And if you think about the history of quality, I mean, think about so many methods that have come through, right? So the 7 quality tools or TQM or DMAIC or PDCA. And so it is constantly evolving. And in our book, The Problem Solver's Toolkit, we focus on 35 tools that are most commonly used, but we also talk about when you're learning initially, following a map and using the tools as suggested is a good way to learn them. And as you become more advanced and more frequent in application, you can do some off-roading and take it off the beaten path because, you know, it's your application. And so we really promote that too. And we do find that, you know, even us, we've been doing this 20 years and we're constantly evolving some of the things that we use. And I am always learning something from my students and as well as people that I collaborate with, like Mike Osterling at San Diego State.
Yeah, that's 30 years, you youngster.
Okay.
Yeah, and those, you know, there's a lot of examples of what Tracy's talking about with, or what you're talking about with, you know, adapting and making the tools work for you. There's a lot of 8 Waste examples that have been completely adapted for healthcare. People have competitions on coming up with a 9th Waste. I always liked storage as a 9th Waste. When I did work at Cisco Systems, they wanted everyone to consider storage to be a utility. You know, they called their grounds a campus, and if you were going to keep something in storage, that meant they needed in that building to have lighting and heating and security and other aspects of maintenance. So storage was considered a waste. And then recently, Jerry Wright, another guest of this podcast, president of AME, the Association for Manufacturing Excellence, just published a blog about the 7 S. The 6th S was safety. The 7th is security. So maintaining security in modern processes is a huge deal. So 5S had to evolve.
Yes, trying different things definitely advances learning. I just went to Costco Optical Labs with a tour with UC San Diego's Lean Six Sigma Green Belt class, and it was amazing. Carlos Vallejo did an awesome job. He is a lifelong learner, and I've been there before, but things are always changing there. Even the tour was different. So trying new things is in their blood. And this kind of thinking helped them avoid spending $700,000 on with a vendor who said they would solve a problem. And an employee found a 70-cent countermeasure.
So, that's a crazy return. 70 cents and they saved $700,000.
Yes. And I have not been approved to share exactly, you know, with the world what the details of that was, but I'm working on Carlos to maybe write a blog about it.
Oh, that sounds great. And we also saw this in Japan. I remember two instances where company leadership adapted the tools. One was the leader of continuous improvement for the Shinkansen cleaning crew. He helped turn the cleaning process into the 7-minute miracle for the bullet train. You know, they could clean and turn around the entire train in 7 minutes. That made the news. There's great videos about it. But he has his own take on PDCA, kind of rewrote it to work for him. And then the town of Ashikaga that we visited, a few places there, they changed the order of 5S. They decided that shine, the cleaning step, should come before sort, where you decide where everything goes. And once I heard that, it makes total sense. And now I permanently reconsidered the order of 5S.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think, again, like we've been saying, it's okay to make changes. It's okay to adjust things if they work better. The thing we have to be careful of is changing things for a certain agenda or not being mindful of the intended purpose of those methods and tools. So for example, skipping root cause analysis is a common error we see in new learners. They go right from the problem in define to solution in improve. And that's really not doing the proper analysis. So in essence, disregarding the learning and the point of PDCA or DMAIC. And as long as we keep in mind that we're respectful of the intended purpose and use, I think making adjustments in alignment with that can be a really good thing.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Learn it first, adapt it later. I'm Elizabeth Swan, and you're listening to the Just in Time Cafe podcast. In a short while, we'll get to hear my interview with Lori Fiorica and Hillary Hellman from Ancillary Care Strategies, which is a healthcare consulting group. But first, it's the printed page.
So the title of this book is about accidental instructional designers. And that was us, right, Elizabeth?
That was us. That's right. This month's book is The Accidental Instructional Designer by Cami Bean. And for those of you whose eyes just glazed over, instructional design is kind of what a lot of you do in the Lean Six Sigma world. You're doing it all the time. You know, problem solving is a basic human skill, but if you want someone to be able to take advantage of the tools and methods and techniques of Lean Six Sigma, you have to teach them. So this book is all about what works and what doesn't work when you're teaching. So we picked up this book for two reasons. One, it's on a lot of people's top 10 lists for books on learning and education. And two, because of the title, as Tracy said, we started out as accidental instructional designers.
Absolutely. So when you're in the world of consulting and you're helping organizations with Lean and Six Sigma, a big part of that is training. And sometimes they say, you know what, we need a training that is more specific for what we do and how we apply it. So we kind of fell into it, if you will. And we're starting to help people with designing some of these materials. And so it really just became a part of what we do. But I think sometimes people don't realize that when you start designing materials, it's instructional design. You know, we're so used to just developing presentations, but there's a lot. The more I learn, the more I'm humbled by so much we could know in this instructional design field. And if everybody just knew a little bit more about it, I think people's experience in learning would be much better. So my favorite quote in this book, The Accidental Instructional Designer, is, why is so much e-learning so boring? And she writes, because we're obsessed with designing information when instead we should be designing experiences. And that really was great. We need to focus on what people need to do, not what they need to know. And that was really, really powerful, because I really feel like that's where people get lost, is they're so focused on disseminating information and not really thinking about the experience that will help them learn it completely.
Yeah.
So the good news is, and it's sort of a validation when you read the book, we already knew we don't like to use jargon. Obviously, a lot of our materials online, you know, we talk about the English term and then we say what the Japanese term is, because what we found over the years too is a lot of people see it as a barrier. They don't understand it right away. We also use humor. That's how we roll. I mean, it's, you know, you can't take yourself too seriously. And, you know, people learn more when they're having a good time. We also use visuals because we find them interesting. We have both been victims, and I'm sure many people have been victims of death by PowerPoint. So we know it doesn't work.
Yeah. It was fun to read about all the things we figured out how to do right. But it's also a good book for tips on what really goes into good educational pieces, like, you know, face-to-face learning, e-learning, blended learning. She warns about with e-learning what she calls clicky, clicky, bling, bling. She said, you know, don't include interaction for interaction's sake. It's just annoying, which is, I love that. Another great point is to give people a way to find out more, where to find extra resources, you know, and as you said, it's what we did with our book, the Problem Solvers Toolkit. We provided basic information on tools, some common mistakes, how to address them. Then we gave them the readers links if they wanted to do sightseeing. If you want to get more background on topic, there's webinars, templates, videos. So the same is true for our Greenbelt training. In our latest upgrade, we added links to like deep dive webinars if people wanted to know more.
Yes. So I will add to is we've been in the e-learning space for 7 years now. And I still see people, I hear about from other consultants, you know, e-learning, I don't really like that. But sadly, I'm sure people have been exposed to very bad e-learning in the past, but it's a great way to teach. And, you know, it makes me sad to think people have just discarded it because maybe they have not a great experience. So a couple other tips she talks about. Gamification is a big e-learning arena that she talks about, but she does caution people not to add games just for the fun factor. It's got to be incorporated with learning. It's not just a competition.
Yeah.
The goal is teaching. So games are good if they align with the purpose of the content. She also references some 9-hole golf game template that has apparently been really overused. Rest assured, there's no golf game at the Bahama Bistro. Although, I don't know, I'm kind of thinking we should do one. I'm just kidding.
I'm not even a golfer.
I'm not even a golfer.
Yeah, I think back to your early point, I think for some e-learning was just, I got a PowerPoint. We'll just put this online. There you go. You know, and that's back to the death by PowerPoint. Another great discovery reading the book is how much she got from John Medina's book, Brain Rules. And we read and reviewed that a while back. There's a review online on our site if you want to read it. But he breaks down the science of how we react the way we do. A lot of his advice stems from our early encounters with saber-toothed tigers, you know. And it results in people being happier with just, you know, 10-minute chunks of content. That's a good attention span before we break things up. That's what she calls digestible chunks of learning. Then you have to grab people's attention again. You know, instead of a tiger, you might be providing them with a story or a startling statistic, something like that.
Yes, and John Medina also points out how much easier it is for us to learn through visuals. I know I'm a huge visual, and pictures speak 1,000 words. We've heard that before. We hear it all the time. And for some reason, we think it maybe doesn't apply to us if we have a lot of information to share. So our brains actually translate every letter and then each word. We do it pretty quickly, but the net result is that reading is the slowest way to learn. That's why we use so many infographics and visuals and all our stuff. And I think in our webinars, we shoot for 0 words per page. That's also a measure. Of course, we do what's right for the topic, but like the author, Cami Bean, we learned a lot from John Medina's Brain Rules. And if you'd like to read a review of Brain Rules or get a link to the instructional designer, we've posted both of those on our website. All right, it's time to announce the coupon code.
This code is for 20% off any of our Lean Six Sigma training and certification courses. That's white belt, yellow belt, green belt, black belt, and lean training.
And if you've joined us at the Just in Time Cafe, just use coupon code 20SUGAR. That's 20SUGAR during checkout. Make sure to use it soon, since the coupon code will expire at the end of November. Coming up next is today's special. Elizabeth, give us a little preview of your interview with Lori and Hillary.
Absolutely. They were wonderful travel companions on Katie Anderson's Japan study trip. And like us, you know, it was a rare opportunity for them to be learners as opposed to leaders. And they had really keen observations about the culture of improvement in Japan. And like us, it changed their thinking on some fundamentals. They were great guests, so stay tuned for that.
Welcome to today's special. My guests today are Hillary Hellman and Lori Fiorica, President and Vice President of Ancillary Care Strategies. Welcome, Lori and Hillary.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Glad to be with you.
Absolutely. Hillary, your background is healthcare, and you know the medical world really well because you spent your early years providing physical and occupational therapy in hospitals, schools, clinics, you name it. So your leadership capability is informed by your practical experience. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I hadn't looked at it like that, but yes, I guess that would be accurate. Definitely from the clinical side first, and leadership clinically and then administratively.
Yeah, so over 25 years in this sphere. And then Lori and I are pretty sure we met back in the 90s when Lori was at Kodak.
Yeah.
And Lori, you were involved in operational excellence efforts at Kodak. And I was a consultant just helping with the simulation. So we think that we were in the same room at some point.
Yes, I think it was at Kodak Park.
And yes. You got to apply your continuous improvement background to healthcare when you worked at the world-renowned Theta Care, which I didn't even realize until I started really scrutinizing your background. For those listeners who don't know, there's a great book called On the Mend by Dr. John Toussaint about bringing lean to the healthcare world. And it looks like you two met while Lori was Chief Operating Officer of Dreyer Medical Clinic. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes.
I had, at the same time I was with Theta Care, I was with a consulting firm, and one of my other clients was Dreyer Medical Clinic. So I started there leading their lean transformation, and then ended up coming on board directly in operational excellence, and then eventually became the COO. And Hillary and ACS, we were the client, and they were supporting our therapy. Our CEO had worked with them at another client prior. And so they came in and took care of our therapy service line. So we, you know, our operational excellence team focused on all the other service lines. We had 32 specialties. So,
wow.
So that's where we got to know each other.
we were thrown into the same room together, and neither of us was happy about it because we each thought we had the best lead on the day. And it turned out that from my standpoint, it totally changed the way we looked at our business, the way that we, the language that we used. And we had been doing a lot of things that were consistent with lean tools and lean principles and processes, but just didn't have the language for it. So meeting Lori was just like the light at the end of the tunnel. It was awesome. And then we just got to create a new tunnel.
Mm-hmm. I love that. But you didn't start off thinking this was going to be good.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Two strong women in the same room, you either.
Well, so part of this is obviously when you're going through change in different areas, on the therapy side, there was pushback because it was basically pulling it from the 1980s into the future. And we were, I think that was like an orthopedics event. And so the director of therapy at the time had the best intent. She wanted to expose Hillary to the lean process and the events that we were doing. The problem is she didn't really tell either one of us or set the stage. So typically, you know, the team dynamics, it becomes pretty difficult when people are coming in and out of the room. So part of that was I was annoyed because I really didn't know them at the time and they had just popped in and she wasn't sure why she was there. She thought they were just trying to avoid doing the work.
Change.
Yeah, it's strange. So we chuckled about it later because we were both like, what were you doing in the room?
I still think though the meeting where Lori was COO and I knew that I was reporting to her from the outside was one of the most powerful meetings I've ever been in. The very first words out of her mouth were, how do you get paid? And then the words that followed that were, what barriers can I remove? And in all of my years of working, consulting, having my own businesses, no one had ever said anything quite so powerful. And that was just a pivotal moment. That really just changed the direction of.
She and Todd just stopped and looked at each other for like a couple minutes and just looked at me and said, we've been told no so much. We just talk in the hallway about who's going to ask the question because it's always no. So when I said that, and I was genuine, like, what do we need to do to make it better? They both just stopped in their tracks. And then in that one meeting, you know, it was pretty, all the business cases were there. Some of it was basic equipment, you know, really things that didn't take Herculean efforts to get. And so we laugh about that meeting a lot because I think it resonated for both of us. Some of the things they were getting pushed back on was just kind of penny smart, dollar foolish.
Well, the description you just gave of that meeting is kind of palpable. Like, first of all, I know that feeling of you're describing when there's a total lack of clarity. You don't know why people are doing what they're doing. It's not really clear what the premise is, what the goals are. And the other one is just that moment of using how powerful it is when someone asks you those key questions, like that power of inquiry. But that's really nice. Thank you for that. I saw in your background, I was like, oh, I can see where Natalie met. It's not just when you met, it's when you really understood, you shifted each other's thinking. And that's really nice to hear about. And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that my role had changed as well. So in that, I was a teacher. I was, you know, teaching and leading the lean process itself. But once in a decision making, my questions and my approach had to change because at that point, I feel the ultimate and most important goal of any executive is managing your resources effectively and removing barriers. So it just seemed very obvious to me. And for them, it was this, you know, a big moment. So,
yeah, hugely necessary. So that's your background, each other. And then I was so psyched to meet both of you on the recent trip to Japan, the Japan study trip with Katie Anderson of KBJA Consulting. So getting to meet both of the treat, you guys made everything better. The bus rides, the dinners, the karaoke.
Karaoke will go down in history.
Oh, we'll go down in history. We're going to have to burn some of the videos, but that's okay.
Yeah, I was going to say. Not for prime time.
Yeah, not for prime time. So you guys are great company, but I'm curious about what you took away from the trip. So we got to tour the Ashikaga Red Cross Hospital in Japan, in Ashikaga, Japan, and interview the president, Dr. Satoru Matsumoto. I toured a number of lean hospitals, but this one was a completely different experience for me. So I'm wondering what struck you most about that visit or that facility?
So I'm not sure that the hospital itself identified itself with lean, so to speak. But I think the most impressive part to me was the physician. I don't know if he was the CEO or president of the hospital. And as he talked with great humility and such pride and joy at the same time about their facility. I think the biggest thing is they are one of the only critical care hospitals in their region, and they have things like earthquakes and tsunamis and things that we certainly don't have to contend with here personally for us. But the way they had designed the building, their use of visuals, they had, so two things. First, it was the physician himself and how much pride he had in the hospital and how he highlighted to us throughout, you know, very unique characteristics and things they had done to be very patient-centered. For example, in one of the rooms, it was a hospice room, and they had sliding doors that would go over the mirror because they found that, you know, people in that situation don't always want to see themselves in the mirror. So there was very small touches like that that he highlighted. And then the other thing was that there were three or four wind, what are those called, Elizabeth? Wind towers for like a wind farm.
Oh, the turbines. And,
yes, the turbine. And on the top of the turbine, each one, there was four of them, they had a color. And they had blue, red, yellow, green. And he explained to us that not only was that to generate energy for the hospital, but it was also a visual. So when they did have casualties or folks they were bringing in, I think green was the least critical. They were probably first aid. Yellow was more serious. Red was critical. And then blue was people that had passed away. And so I was fascinated that these wind towers are so high in the air and they're standing out, and they found a way to make those practical in addition to generating electricity, but also to identify for folks from a command center which people were in which area, so what type of personnel they would need to respond.
Yeah, they were also striking to look at. I mean, they were kind of, that the color was useful, but it was also, you know, coming into the hospital, it was nice to see.
Yeah, yep, it was, they spent a lot of time in the aesthetics, not in a frivolous way, but in safety. There was a heavy focus on safety, patient safety, patient comfort, everything centered around patients and families, making sure the rooms, they had private rooms, they had chairs, very nice chairs that readily transitioned into couches so people could stay overnight. Just very beautiful, welcoming when you first came in, and a big thing, emphasis on safety. Apparently, he said, and I don't know if it's people from overseas, but people were concerned about their safety. So they put in a lot of mechanisms to control entrance and the flow of people.
The signage was good, and the pathfinding. So you didn't have to read the language in order to be able to figure out where you needed to go. So they used color, they used shape, they used a lot of things that made it easy for people to follow and feel comfortable.
Pictures,
which I thought was really effective. They also, it was extremely clean, the sense of pride. The fact that he walked through and people seemed to know who he was, and there just seemed to be a very high level of respect, which was a sensitive area for me on this trip, just realizing how so often we don't have that.
The sense of respect.
The respect.
Well, and the pride. And the it's just, he was a unique combination of pride and humility. So mm-hmm. They were all one staff. You didn't see, I didn't personally see anything to do with real hierarchy. You know, the nurses were ecstatic we were there. They were just so thrilled to be showing us their hospital, so proud of it, as well as the work they were doing, but yet with such humility around it. So it's probably harder to explain, but it was impactful.
The other thing I remember, you talking about the nursing, I think I saw on the wall, there was a whole board of the nurses sort of introducing themselves. There's pictures of them and describing who they were. And that was for the patients and for the patients' families, so that they knew, you know, that it wasn't just, oh, there's a new nurse. It's like, you could know exactly who was caring for you. You could go find out background if you wanted.
Yes, they were big poster boards. So So even, and I think we saw that throughout Japan, even in the other industries, they're back to that whole piece around people and the appreciation for their staff, that was very evident in the hospital because it was, everything was personalizing. So a picture of them, kind of who they were, what's their name, what type of role they played. And those were in different floors so people could see who they were. And we also saw that in several other facilities. It didn't matter if it was frontline operations people or executives, there was pictures and names throughout these plants to really help people identify one another.
Well, and identify as individuals.
And you're right, it was, even at like tier three Toyota manufacturing, you know, steel plants, it is the same thing.
Right, very kind of a rough environment, but yeah, a lot centered around really knowing the human beings that are employees there.
What kinds of things do you look forward to trying to incorporate in your work or in your efforts?
I think that, you know, one of the things for us and one of the reasons that we were really excited to take the trip is that when you're the one that's in the front of the room and leading all the time, whether it's in our own organization or with our clients, you know, you hear yourself a lot and you try to lead people and bring them along. But sometimes in order to stay fresh and really move forward and, you know, be innovative, we felt it was necessary to step back. And this was a great opportunity to be able to do that. So one of the things that I came away with on this trip was just how critically important it is to have that top level leadership where it's clear and it's concise, it's clear. There is a vision, a mission that they live by, not just words that are on a poster somebody has to look for. And the real importance of that in setting the stage for the rest of the organization. So, you know, a lot of times things become so collaborative and people don't want to be seen as being contrary or whatever that is not transparent. And that doesn't tend to lead to a good result. And I think that this trip just really solidified that there's nothing wrong. You know, it's certainly desirable to have a very well-established leadership team, a leader at the top, and people that are very comfortable knowing what their roles, responsibilities are, and in what framework they're expected or encouraged to participate.
Well, and Elizabeth, you probably can relate to this. And some of this is just not what happened there. It's as you're back and you're thinking through things. And maybe this is obvious, but the fact that, especially in healthcare, there is such high turnover in the executive ranks, things are moving so fast. And also in industry and I don't know if this all started with performance based when money became, you know, a really big driver, but in these companies we saw there, the owners or the families that owned have been there for 40 years or 30 years. So some of that pride and that vision actually was, those were those people that owned or started those companies. And so it was a value system to them. And part of what I realized is when there's so much turnover at the top and you're not, you haven't had enough time or energy to really embed a culture to take hold and take life, that becomes really hard for an organization to grow and develop because they almost start back at square one every time. Maybe not literally, but certainly figuratively, because any executive is going to come in and have their own type of person or their own style, or one might be collaborative, one might be command control, one may be financially centered, one may be people centered. So I do think part of this with their energy around their future vision and driving results and then pride in their people had to do with the fact that they grew that from something that was small or non-existent to it being really their own. And then as they handed it to their kids, they made sure that their kids were also kind of indoctrinated with their idea or vision about how it should be. Not to say that they won't improve upon it or there's things they may, you know, not really appreciate and you don't know until they get in there, but I definitely see a disconnect when there's an extensive amount of turnover at the top, and that is something we didn't see over there.
That is something that I continue to wrestle with because there's even a stigma for people who've only had one job. Like if you go to apply for a job, regardless of the industry, you you're looked at as inflexible. You've only done one thing or worked in one place. How could you possibly flex to the culture and the processes that are here? So people are expected to have numerous jobs, but you're right. Over there, it was assumed that you would want to have lifetime employment. And that was the goal. I think one of them said, I hire slowly because we're not going to let people go.
I mean, even looking at Toyota, not to belabor the point because they're just so far advanced, that was just awesome. But if you even look at that, they created a business system that survives, if you will, the different executives. However, as they were learning and implementing and evolving, we had learned that they came back, it was about 20 or 30 years in, and they realized that their managers were not exhibiting the mindset and the just developmentally the same passion, energy, or discipline around the PDCA process, the use of A3 thinking. And so they actually put in, I was fascinated that they put in, they spent 2 years, each manager, senior leader had to do their own personal A3, and then they had to meet with the four or five executives once or twice a year to actually describe and define their own development and their own learning. So the problem they saw was that the leaders that were second generation leaders were not internalizing and applying leadership the way they intend it to be, which is a very purposeful. So they went back to the drawing board with that group and they got to root cause and they realized they hadn't done a good enough job of development, and they focused that much energy and time, as you can imagine, the number of leaders, and really put them on the hot seat to show how developmentally they were progressing their own leadership style and skills.
And what strikes me is what you pointed out, which was we dealt with a lot of companies, or maybe Hillary, you pointed this out. A lot of these companies we were dealing with the founders. We were dealing with the people, that it was a family run business. And then they passed it off to they were passing it off to number one son, or in the case of Magura, it was actually his daughter. And that helped them control that culture and keep things going as they designed. But Toyota's public. So I think what you're describing is that was that loss, and how do you deal with that? And they saw it, they didn't have the control. They didn't have the same, they were going to lose that culture if they didn't consciously and actively reinforce it.
Yeah. And they don't just bring in outsiders. And sometimes it's good, I suppose, if you think outside objective, and in some industries or cultures, that's very helpful. But it still needs to be purposeful and thoughtful, because it can radically change your culture. And if you're doing that every year, people shut down. They just start punching a clock, come in and go home. They just figure they'll outlast the next set. But that's not true engagement. So that was a pretty powerful takeaway, just the impact of high turnover among your senior leadership.
Well, and there was conversation about the fact that their population is decreasing and therefore their workforce is decreasing. So they're bringing in foreign workers for the first time. And several of them commented on their concern about the culture in the future, because, I would expect that that will be at risk and that they'll start to see changes, just like any melting pot or place where you start to, have people from other backgrounds become involved.
Yeah, I think that on many levels, as a company and as a country, even outside of what we were looking at, there's the families were struggling with finding people in the family who wanted to run the rice fields. So they're also leaving for the city, or the kids were leaving for the city. And to your point, they're for the first time opening up their borders and inviting workers in from Southeast Asia. So that, as you said, changes the culture of the company and the culture of the country. Hillary, I wanted to ask you more about what you were describing, about what really struck you in terms of the respect, respect for the workers, respect for each other. Are there other things you think about with how do you bring that into your work, into the groups you're working with?
It's interesting, Elizabeth. When I thought about that, I thought, where does that begin? And usually we talk about respect beginning at home. And then when you reflect back to our tour of the school with the second graders, being so aware and respectful when it came to their lunch, and that their recess basically was cleaning their school. And, you know, I know that we were all standing there, but there was definitely a sense of pride in those kids because they were taking part in the environment around them. And then when you look at, you know, throughout our trip, there were no trash cans or very few. We all got to the point of, you know, of taking our trash with us because we weren't going to be seen as leaving it or being disrespectful. So all of that respect, to me, it really is the way they start very, very early. And I think we need to look at that potentially and see how we can change ourselves culture-wise and then also business-wise. So a lot of that's just been in having conversations with people since we've been back, reflecting, sharing some of our experiences and seeing kind of the aha moment when they first you hear, well, you know, we would never be able to do that with our kids, to, well, maybe that wouldn't be so bad. And I think that some of this is going to, I think we need a shift. We're at a point now where everything is disposable or, you know, replaceable. And we expect people to move from job to job after 2 or 3 years. I think all of that ties in. So in our work and taking it in, you know, I don't believe that you can impose a culture. I believe you develop it, and that in every organization we're in, culture is certainly a big piece. So I think a lot of our learnings and our takeaways from there will come into just the day-to-day as we're working with a group. And yeah, even as much as, you know, even as much as cleaning up their space or helping prepare when it comes time for a lunch, not, you know.
There was a very big consciousness that they were part of something bigger.
Right.
And one of the ways we have done that when we've gone in, and there has been aha moments, people think of respect as how you treat one another. But when you talk about it in terms of a manager, back to the what barriers can I remove, it's pointing out to leaders, whether they're a team leader or a supervisor, respect is also about giving people the tools they need to do their job, respecting and honoring that they have work to do and giving them enough time to do that. Owning the work environment we're responsible for. So the management processes, the various workflows, the manager is ultimately responsible for. And it's respect to people to make those as easy as possible to get correct the first time. And so people will often sit back and go, oh, I just think of respect. And, you know, they think of it as an emotion, but it can also be a verb.
Yes. Yes. Actively respecting. That's nice. So tell me, what are you guys working on now that you would like to tell our listeners?
Oh, we'd tell you, but we'd have to kill. No.
Yeah, you can't get to me.
We are, we're in the midst of, I think, for ourselves, with a refocus of, you know, where do we see ourselves in 5 years and 3 years? The changes are happening so quickly that we are thinking about different approaches. So our approach up to this point on the lean side and the medical practice side has been more event focused, but that's harder because our niche market is small and medium sized companies. So we're looking at alternative ways and mechanisms in the work to help do knowledge transfer and teach and coach, but not necessarily have to pull people out of the work for days, which is really hard because that's a lot of where the learning takes place. So that's on one piece of it. We're also looking at kind of wanting to put our money where our mouth is. So, you know, what is there a model clinic, or whether it's created or developed or assumed, that we can really apply principles to and have it be somewhere that can be a model of what it is we're trying to teach. So those are a couple of things that are floating around.
That one's the most exciting because it really allows us to be able to demonstrate what we believe in and actually have it so that people can visit and be part of that. It's much more difficult when you go in and you are there for a transformation and then you at some level leave, whereas really looking, and probably some of this is from the trip, really not wanting to be jumping in and jumping out so much as being part of something for a longer period of time to really see it come to fruition and continue to grow.
And the other piece of that too is we're finding that with the changes, when people implement an EMR, issues with billing, there's so many moving pieces that it's getting away. And so we also have different management services that help us to either compartmentalize or do expansive. So if somebody just needs help with credentialing or with billing or billing redesign, you know, those are things. So it's not just coming in and saying, hey, let's redesign your clinic, basically, but other specific areas or specific key constraints that we can work with to help. So we just are continuously trying to find ways to fill needs, especially on the healthcare side, as it's just changing so quickly. The insurance companies are struggling. Everybody is just struggling to keep up, and the processes are not keeping pace. It's still a very heroistic, highly personal environment in healthcare.
No, it's clearly a palpable issue, and I wish you guys were not in Arizona. I wish you were closer to Boston and me, but because I'm really glad that you're leading the charge or leading a charge in places you can in helping healthcare get through this, and that you're clearly informed around what does that mean for leaders? What does that mean for processes? And how do we keep that and build that respectful culture? So it's exciting to hear you talk. I love the idea of your model. I'd love to talk more as you talk to you guys again once you get that rolling and see where you've gone with it.
Yeah. That's great. But we're in New York right now, so we're closer to you than you think.
So you're maybe enjoying some rare sunshine on the East Coast right now.
Yes, and cool weather. But yeah, I mean, our clients are national, so that's nice, you know, but it comes with its, everybody thinks it's glamorous, but it comes with its challenges.
Yeah, we know the glamour of plane travel and well, travel in general.
Absolutely.
It's lost a little over the years. Yeah, flexibility.
Well, flexibility and have all of your cords or all of your devices charged.
Well, and we enjoyed getting to know you, and thank you for your book. And it was fun. I mean, it was like-minded people interested in learning. We're all obviously lifelong learners. And we appreciate the opportunity to talk with you because I think we're all just a tad, if we're a bunch of passionate people, we're probably all just a tad bit more passionate because of our trip.
Yeah, I think that. And also, I think it was exciting to have more than 60% of us be women and see all these really powerful women leaders and thinkers. That was exciting.
Amen.
I agree.
Amen.
That was really wonderful. I said it was a great group.
Yeah, no, they were wonderful, wonderful and fun. You've been listening to the Just in Time Cafe podcast. My guests today have been Hillary Hellman and Lori Fiorica of Ancillary Care Strategies. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your wisdom with our listeners.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Definitely tune in for Tracy's next webinar, Introduction to Process Management, on Thursday, October 17th at 11 a.m. Pacific. And we've got a great new Greenbelt offering you guys might be interested in, especially if you'd appreciate expert support to ensure you have a successful project. Just register for an enhanced version of our Greenbelt course, which is Greenbelt Training and Certification with Project Completion. We'll provide a link on our site with this episode. You'll get email support from our Master Black Belts to help you select the right project and ensure your project is completed successfully. That is all for just $1,299. That includes Greenbelt course access and email project support. If you need even more support, like multiple live web meetings, you can register for our one-on-one project coaching, where you'll get 6 one-hour web meetings with a Master Black Belt to guide you through each phase of your project using the DMAIC format. That's Define, Measure, Analyze, Improve, and Control. And that is for $1,499 for the web meeting series. So we'll leave a link for the web meeting series too. It's so great to have a guide when you're learning. That's a wonderful option.
Tune in next month for my interview with Josh Beaudry, founder of Lipstick Skateboards.
Thanks again for spending time with Tracy and me here at the Just in Time Cafe.
See you next month.